Greetings in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. We are on Lesson 16 of Reformation Overview, and we're dealing with Switzerland between the years 1528 to 1530, or 1531. As the Reformation advanced, its desire was to advance without force, but with spiritual weapons of the Word of God and the Spirit of God. The sword cannot place men into the kingdom of Christ. The Spirit of God must do this through regeneration. However, arms and diplomacy began to infiltrate the Reformation surrounding Zwingli. He felt that it was important to not only deal with spiritual questions, but also questions of the state. He decided it was his lot to help promote alliances and liberty through the evangelical states. The Roman Catholics despised the alliance between the states. The evangelicals set the Catholics that sat on city councils at check on many fronts as a result. Various other cantons were forced to consider the evangelical course, and Thurgovia and Rheinthal also voted under some duress to have the gospel preaching throughout their cities. In opposition to the alliances being made, Austria made negotiations with some of the cantons to aid them in turning to the German monarch for support instead of these alliances. Zurich held a conference in order to discuss the matter and sent a representative to the mountain cantons in order to help alleviate the matter. Zwingli wanted to give them an ultimatum, but Bern thought that it would provoke civil war. Unfortunately, tension mounted, and a nearby pastor named Kaiser, traveling with his family, was arrested and burnt alive by the Catholic influences there. Zwingli spoke out against this and encouraged the people not to fear to take up arms against such intolerable cruelty. Zwingli believed that if he could crush the Catholic mountain rebellion in alliance with Austria, that there would finally be free preaching throughout Switzerland. The discontented evangelicals found solace in Zwingli, the reformer and political advisor. Though he was summoning the people to be forceful against their enemies, he thought this was acceptable, since he only had the freedom of the gospel and mine. Anthony Ab Acker was sent to Baden with an army of 500 men, and Zurich responded with tumult. Men everywhere began raising up arms. 4,000 men gathered under Captain George Bührer at Kappel. This stirred the councils, and they petitioned Zwingli to not go to war with the Romish cantons, but Zwingli did not want to sit idly by and watch the Roman amass an army against the gospel. Men were amassing in various cantons ready to go to blows with the Catholics. The 1st Division of Zurich of 2,000 men were ready to march under the command of William Toming. Before setting out, Abelli, a landman of Glarus, rose up with news. 5 cantons are ready to march with you. But Ebli believed he could obtain peace so that the towns would not be overrun with war. Ebli returned to Zug, and the army stood down, believing Ebli was an honorable man and spoke sincerely. If bloodshed could be averted, this would be the way history should follow. Ebli's message returned, and the cantons would not find peace, but were ready to fight. A conference was to be heard between the two armies. Delegates were hoping to avert the battle. A treaty was made, June 26, 1529, but only liberty of conscience was gained, and not the free preaching of the gospel that Zwingli hoped for. Although liberty of conscience was breaking forth, that meant that those of the evangelical persuasion had power to enact reforms in the city that still needed reformation. In Schaffhausen, they moved the God set in her church and replaced him with the Bible, ridding them of the Romish Mass. In Zurzach, evangelicals marched into the church while a priest was preaching, and Tufel stopped him. The priest ran out of the church, and the images were torn down in the church. Tufel's name meant devil, and the Roman Catholics believed the devil had entered the canton and sparked that aspect of the Reformation there. The forest cantons also moved towards Reformation under the preaching of Friedolin Brunner, and the villages of Schwanden and Ruti, high mountain villages, were transformed by the vote of the people against the Mass. Finally, in the suburbs of Appenzell, in Rhodes, reform took place, but Catholic dissenters were afraid that it would carry over into the Alps and then ultimately into Italy. In looking at the Swiss Reformation on Italy, nothing could be more glorious than the translation of the Bible into Italian. A monk of the Augustinian order named Egidio, a Porta, struggled with the Reformation for a long time and believed God told him to finally approach Zwingli and he would tell him what to do. Zwingli told him to translate the Bible into Italian and he would have it published. Egidio accomplished this at the end of 1526, and he desired the full Reformation of Italy. As much as cantons were reforming slowly, the Catholics were also gaining cities and members to their cause as well. Zurich attentively watched the progress of these cantons, and the two parties widened the breach, created even more extensively. The Reformation had taken a turn towards political involvement, and Zwingli could think of nothing other than a Christian state to rise up. Some people believe that Zwingli's political career was the height of his fame, but those acknowledging the biblical manner of freedom see this involvement in the state as his greatest downfall. Zwingli played the reformer as well as the magistrate. He even met with Philip of Hesse, he who was overcome by the sword at Augsburg, and agreed that this course of action in politics was the right course for the Swiss Reformation. Bern raised its voice against the idea of a Christian state, thinking that an alliance with Philip of Hesse and the evangelical states would be dangerous. However, Zwingli viewed the alliance between Charles and Clement as a grave problem, and unless the Catholic influence was overthrown once and for all in Switzerland, the Reformation would be over. Zwingli agitated the various cantons and cities against one another, which caused an uproar all through Switzerland because of his views politically. Zurich then made a declaration that one who rejects the emperor would reject the pope as well. Thus, the emperor should be rejected. Zwingli saw Charles as a tyrant, and that the people, as a unified whole, should oppose him. At Marburg, both Zwingli and Philip of Hesse drew up an alliance against the emperor. Zwingli's preaching shifted to politics. He did not only desire the free proclamation of the gospel through Switzerland, but he desired to see the country transformed politically as well. This became the focus of his preaching and his influence. The authorities of the cantons thought that creating religious liberty through means of war was dangerous. Zwingli's plans for reform in this manner did not go over well at the diet held at Aarau. Zurich and Bern simply could not give in to killing their brothers, the Waldstätts, and then proclaiming the gospel for those who died would have their fate sealed. Zwingli continued to preach for the reconstruction of the state, but the Christian in him soon diminished, and all that was left was the patriot. Moved by Zwingli's preaching, the cities of Zurich, Bern, and others decided to shut off supplies to the cantons that were opposing them. Interestingly enough, when such discord was streaming through the country, it was not Switzerland that was an attempted remedy, but France and its intervention in this regard. Zurich intervened over France in the five cantons and told them if the free preaching of the word was allowed, then they would give aid. France secretly, though, told them that they would come to their aid and that they could not allow the free preaching of the word as Zurich understood it. The five cantons opposed Zurich and Bern, and a diet held there soon stood their ground. Zurich and Bern pressed the cantons to acknowledge that in persecuting the ministers and burning one at the stake, they were violating the treaty on the liberty of free conscience that had been drawn up. Zwingli saw the Reformation was in danger, but what could he do to stop its destruction? War was the only answer. He preached in Zurich, stating that unless the council followed his advice, he would step down as a reformer. The five cantons opposed to the Reformation decided to hold a diet at Lucerne and voted for war. Zurich was asleep, and the Waldstätts were strategizing for war against their patriotic brothers. The rumor of war broke out over the land, and when it reached Zwingli, he didn't believe it. But in 4 days, rumor had it that Zurich would be attacked by the cantons in a civil war. Zwingli preached on October 8th, for his last time. A messenger interrupted the sermon and brought news that the cantons were indeed assembled and ready to make war the next day. Zurich and their allies marched into the surrounding town and entered the deserted churches, tearing down the images and idols as they marched closer to the battle at Lucerne. The ever-marching five cantons frightened the other Swiss allies. Some smaller regiments were dispatched under various leaders, hoping to meet the enemy while en route. It seems that Cappel would be the place where the battle met. Zwingli parted with his family, knowing he would not return. He actually preached this many days prior, stating that all of this hardship took place to accomplish his death. Not only just in Zwingli's, but in every house there was lamentation and weeping. There were not enough men gathered together to fight effectively, and those who were going to battle knew it. They should have had 4,000 men, but so far only 700 had gathered to fight in the critical place where the enemy would show his face. Though the five cantons were ready to attack Cappel, the city itself was still in a state of mild confusion. They had not assembled properly and were attempting to have their army in order, and the stations of the men being plotted along with the artillery stations around the battlefield were in a bit of confusion as well. The five cantons moved into Zug, and they stopped to take an oath of war there. The small number of men in Cappel saw the oath-bound cantons marching forward and prepared to fight them, though outnumbered. Zwingli, upon his march with the army of Zurich to the location of Cappel, even prayed to heaven that God would intervene and deliver those men. At noon, a council at Cappel desired to convene in hopes of peace, but there was no time. At 1 o'clock, the cantons fired the first shot against the citizens of Cappel. Shots were fired throughout the next 2 hours, and the army of Zurich, of whom Zwingli marched, finally came to the aid of her brothers who were already engaged in battle. The plan was to send small bands of men at various stages of the battle through to meet the enemy and stop them in order to overpower their advancement. The five cantons did not fully advance, but simply continued to fire shots over into the city and the surrounding forests. Cappel thought that the full advancement and strike of the five canton army would happen the next day. However, some impertinent men on the side of Cappel forced the hand of the five cantons, and they readied their whole army to advance in a single blow at that very hour. The skirmishes that were taking place in the milieu gunfire now changed. The five cantons fired in union upon the battlements of Cappel, and the full advancements of the enemy army moved forward to attack. The army used the woods for cover and slowly advanced, firing against Cappel. The armies moved forward while at the same time sending in skirmishes to fight and disrupt the stations and men of Cappel on that other side. John Camley, charged with holding the defense of the standards, was overtaken when his lines were thinned out. The most distinguished men of Zurich fell one after the other as the enemy, swift and sound of military strategy, advanced upon them. The enemy was victorious at every turn, and they were even allowing the men that they were fighting against to surrender at different points because they were victorious in such a thorough manner. Zwingli was at his post, but was struck by a stone hurled by the enemy in the head. He rose again, but was struck down again by two others in the legs that toppled him. They may kill the body, but they cannot kill the soul. These were Zwingli's last words. He fell back in a meadow by a tree, and he lay there incapacitated. Two soldiers were advancing through the field and came upon Zwingli. Captain Fockinger saw Zwingli lying there and had heard his last words, recognizing it was Zwingli. He raised his sword and cut Zwingli across the neck and killed him, shouting, "Die, heretic, die!" Zwingli was 48 years old when he died on the battlefield. Zwingli was dead. Zurich was in an uproar, and the people were panicking. The Catholics would not overrun the cantons and set up popery once again in as many places as they could. That they couldn't let them do that. The people feared for the lives of those ministers still alive. They hid Leo Juda in a town home, fearing for his life. Myconius had found out that Zwingli had been killed, and his cry, "Zwingli is no more," echoed throughout the city. The city held a funeral, and Leo Juda orated the eulogy. The moment Ferdinand found out that Zwingli had fallen, he was overcome with joy and sent news to King Charles of the victory. The Pope sent more troops to reinforce such a victory at Cappel. They arrived in Zug and joined with their Catholic brothers. They overran Capel and desired to set up the papacy against the city and, in fact, in all of Christendom. However, this presumption was just that, a presumption. The gospel already disseminated throughout the country and would not allow the false hopes of the enemy to raise its head for long. God would be glorified by the work that he was about to take place, even though Zwingli was dead. However, humanly speaking, all seemed a bitter catastrophe. The evangelical army was slowly disbanded, the five cantons called for a council and meeting, and Zurich attended. They were instructed to attempt to keep the faith as much as they could. In the meeting, many of the smaller cantons were given over to the five, and Zurich pressed for the faith to remain established in its respective cities. Zurich had only preserved the faith, but the strength of force was still a threat upon them. The treaty was finished there, and peace seemed to loom in the air. The restoration of popery immediately commenced in Switzerland. The altars, the idols, the images, and the masses were established in many of the smaller cantons that had formerly threw them off. The army of the five cantons continued secretly to overthrow small cities, and all over the countryside, Catholic churches were reestablished. Though such Catholic influence were again rearing its head, the Reformation was more concerned with the death of Zwingli. Ecolampadius was exceedingly saddened at the loss of his friend, and spoke highly of him in commemoration of the enduring work he accomplished on behalf of the gospel. At the same time, the plague came to Basel, and Ecolampadius caught it. The people feared for his life. He called for his children, and talked with them about the everlasting glories of Christ, and that night, he gave up his life. Zwingli and Ecolampadius were now dead, and the church was twice stricken with grief in a short time. Even Luther in Germany was moved at their deaths. He said, "Their death filled me with such intense sorrow that I was near dying myself." If this was all not enough, Henry Bullinger had been ill-treated in Bremgarten, and he was forced to flee. The Reformation was hindered to a great extent for taking a path of war instead of fighting with the spiritual weapons of the Word of God and prayer. God intervened with those who would try to erect a spiritual kingdom by carnal means. His plan, though, was not to simply cast down Switzerland, but raise up others who would later take the torch of the Reformation and carry it further than Zwingli had done. Well, we're going to end there on this lesson, and in the next, we're going to look at England before the Reformation. May the Lord be with you until that time.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying His word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.